You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, there's less ice covering the Great Lakes than usual so far this winter. Find out how it compares with previous years, what we can expect over the next few months, and how it all affects the lake's ecosystems. Now, casserole can take a lot of different forms. Well, whatever you pile up in there, it serves up a feeling of hearty warmth and nourishment. It's a big deal here in the Midwest, whether you call it casserole or hot dish. On this edition of Food Friday, our guest says you can build a better casserole, no recipe required. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a go-to casserole that you like to make for your household or for get-togethers? What separates a good casserole from a great casserole? Do you call it hot dish or casserole? Do you have questions for our guest for some maybe inspiration or troubleshooting? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James Shen is a Wisconsin-based food writer, former culinary deputy editor at Taste of Home. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Casserole can cover a lot of ground. We don't need to have a super precise, exclusive definition. Ballpark, though, what are we talking about? What defines a casserole?
To me, a casserole is anything that's baked in one dish. Like, everything is there. Your protein, your starch, your veg, everything is all in one.
And you said you could help us make casseroles without even a recipe necessarily. And that makes sense to me because I think of making a casserole as assembly as much as cooking. How do we start to plan out a recipe-free casserole?
Well, the way I normally do it is, like, I usually start casseroles from leftovers, that, and I think a lot of people do that, but you don't have to. But to me, there's always five really main important items that are in a casserole. And the first thing would be a protein, because any type of meal, you would want some kind of protein. Now, whether that is meat, fish, seafood, beans, tofu, whatever you want, it should have some kind of protein. And then I always like to have vegetables, no matter what kind of protein you've got. So, I mean, the standard, you got to have onions. I mean, that's just a quick, easy, and inexpensive way to add bulk up your casserole, but give it a lot of flavor. Carrots, celery, anything you've got. But if you've got some broccoli left over from the night before, cauliflower, you got to kind of be careful with some of those vegetables to make sure the textures are kind of in the same ballpark, because you don't want some that are going to cook out first and then kind of get mushy and watery and just kind of like dissolve, where the others are just going to be kind of hard and crunchy. And then after that, I always try to put in some kind of starch or carbohydrate. So like a pasta, rice, you name it, kind of just something to kind of bulk it up. And then some kind of sauce to kind of bind it all together. And so you can do like a thickened stock. You can do a bechamel or white sauce. The classic go-to, I think everyone in this state even knows this, is cream of mushroom soup. So I am not opposed to a cream of mushroom soup or cream of chicken or celery, or there's a whole lot of flavor options out there. The reason is it is a very, very stable product. If you look at the ingredients on it, there's not a whole lot of really bad things in there. It's all really natural ingredients. So go ahead and grab the cream of something soup and kind of go with that. Last thing I've got, topping. You need some kind of topping. I mean, otherwise it's just some kind of boring thing. I always like crunch, whether it be leftover potato chips, pretzels, nuts, you name it. Cheese is a great one, but it's got to have something on top to kind of give it some, give it a little oomph.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ivy is with us in Green Bay. Ivy, what's your casserole?
Hey, my go-to casserole for easy weeknight dinner is a shepherd's pie. I didn't come from the Midwest, so I'm not familiar with hot dish, but I definitely grew up with a ground beef and peas and corn in the middle of that and some mashed potatoes on top.
And do you put your own spin on it, Ivy?
Yeah, my dad actually is the one that taught me this. In our ground beef, we put a little bit of like a Jamaican sauce in it. I don't know, you know, a specific type that we buy, but he has always just gotten this sauce and put that in there. It adds just a little bit of a sweetness, and Kraft American singles on top of our mashed potatoes, because that's how we do it in the South.
Ivy, thanks a lot for sharing that. I love, James, a little, I mean, this is a pretty straight ahead dish here, but a little Jamaican, maybe jerk sauce or something like that. That little twist of flavor can add a whole new wrinkle.
Yeah, and that's what's great about casseroles is you can do that pretty fearlessly. Just add those Jamaican spices. You could also add a chipotle pepper or taco seasoning to your mixture. Give it a little bit of a salvage border kind of spin. Any way you want to do that is great. And I love that you brought up the shepherd's pie, because that is a whole nother starch thing that you could add. Potatoes. In this case, I mean, what we always found at at Taste of Home is when we called it shepherd's pie, and if it wasn't made from lamb, they always got on us because it's supposed to be a cottage pie. And I'm like, whatever. It's still tasty.
Ivy, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We're talking to James Shend, Wisconsin-based food writer, talking about casseroles or hot dish. Is there a difference to you? Do you have a favorite casserole to eat and or make? Is there one you remember maybe from your childhood? Do you need some advice on making a good casserole? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. James, you're a Wisconsin guy. Difference? Casserole? Hot dish? Are they the same thing?
To me, they're the same thing. I really don't differentiate between the two.
Okay, now you mentioned cheese on top, and Ivy mentioned the Kraft singles on top. What are good cheeses for the top of our casserole? What are some that maybe don't work so good?
So if you're going to put them on top, you're going to fold it in or add them to both areas. To me, those stringy, really good, gooey cheeses are a must for a casserole. So like a sharp cheddar, mozzarella, Swiss, they're always good options. Some other stronger cheeses that you may want to be a little bit leery of, especially inside the casserole, things like a blue cheese or a gorgonzola, they pack a whole lot of flavor that can dominate everything very, very quickly. So use those sparingly, if at all. Other cheeses like a feta or some other softer cheeses tend to kind of like disappear if you don't kind of use them in a lot of like in bulk. And so when you use those, I kind of mix them together. So you might use a feta, but then add another something else to it to kind of give it a little bit more, because you don't want a really twangy cheese in there, which a goat cheese or a feta would probably add.
What would you think of the idea of, okay, I've served up the casserole, it's on your plate, and then here's a little bowl of blue cheese or feta or whatever in a spoon, and you could sprinkle some on the top of your dish if you want it.
That is a fantastic idea, because if you're serving kids, I've never met a kid that likes blue cheese, so that would be a great way to do that.
And that reminds me, you mentioned potato chips and pretzels. I have not tried sprinkling that on top of a casserole. When do we sprinkle that on top of the casserole?
So when I usually make a casserole, I'll cover it with foil, or if it has a lid, I'll put that on it for like the first 20 or 30 minutes. Then I take the lid off, and that's when I usually add all the toppings, whether it be cheese or the crunchy pretzels and things like that. That way it doesn't burn, or if you're cooking it for a long period of time covered, you don't want those things to get soggy either. They're going to start to kind of simmer in there and steam a little bit. So add them just as you're going to uncover them. And when I was doing the potato chip thing, it was just, I was making a tuna fish casserole one day, and I had a quarter of a bag of potato chips left over. I just crunched them up and threw them on top, and I'm like, fantastic.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Barb with us now in Appleton. Barb, I guess you have a casserole to share with us?
I do. We always just called it ham dish. It was a recipe that we actually got off of a Bisquick box when my kids were little, and it quickly became a family favorite. It includes broccoli, so it got my kids to eat broccoli, and now even my grandkids love it, so it's still a go-to meal. And I had to kind of laugh when he was saying his requirements to be in the casserole, because I was thinking of this dish right away, and everything he was listing with the protein, the vegetable, it had like all the things that he was talking about.
And what was the sauce on that, Barb? Was it a soup or what?
Oh, it was cream of mushroom.
Okay, there you go. Barb, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Old Bisquick recipe there for ham dish. What do you think?
I love it. And in fact, my mother made something very, very similar. And she had the tiny chunked pineapple in it as well. So I think pineapple, ham, and the broccoli and the mushroom soup actually would probably work really, really well together.
Barb, thanks for sharing that with us. It's Food Friday. We're talking to food writer James Schend here in Wisconsin about making a great casserole. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about casseroles? Do you love them? Not love them? Do you have a specific person or memory in your life that you associate with casseroles? Do you need some advice from our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Wisconsin food writer James Schend. He's with us today helping us perfect our casseroles and hot dishes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a favorite casserole, a secret ingredient, a new wrinkle on an old favorite, or an old favorite you love exactly the way it is. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Menominee. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
All right. As a child, my mom was German. Actually, she was German her whole life. And she would make a casserole called Schlumgolian.
What went into that?
It was just basic, like, noodles, canned corn, tomatoes, ground beef. He had ulcers, so nothing was ever really seasoned, and that's fine because as kids, we didn't know. But on top, it was saltines and bacon, and she never made extra bacon for what my brother and my two sisters would sneak off the top, you know, just shrinkage or whatever. We'd have hell to pay, but it was worth it. And it was just, I could still picture the huge yellow mural bowl or dish, I should say, that she would bake it in. And like I said, when you knew that, man, you knew there was bacon on the top and somebody had to create a diversion and you stuck in there and got it. And it was just, I'm sure I could whip it up. It would never be the same.
Sure.
It was basic stuff, but it's just an incredible, incredible memory as a child. And I'm just wondering if anybody else has ever heard of that, Schlumgolian. I don't even know how to spell it.
I have not encountered that, Paul. James, have you seen anything like that?
I was surprised. I have not heard that at all. So, no, stumped me.
Paul, thanks for sharing the great bacon heist. I love it. And Paul mentioned what his mom made that in, James. Before we go back to our callers, like, what kind of cookware do you recommend for our casseroles?
So it kind of depends on what you want your casserole to turn out to be. The classic would be a 13x9 baking dish. But the thinner you get the pan, the more crunchier and the drier the casserole is going to be. So if you compact it into like an 8x8 or something like that and you get it thicker, then it's going to stay a little bit more moist. The other things you kind of have to worry about is if you're going to broil it after it cooks to kind of brown that top, you're going to want to make sure that that is a broil safe pan. So more often than not, it's going to have to be metal. But if you're going to just put it right onto the dining room table and you want it to stay warm for a while, a ceramic or a glass one is going to keep the heat in it a whole lot more.
All right. Our producer, Tim Peterson, found an All Recipes recipe for Schlumgolian. They're spelling it like Schlumgullion. That looks like the stuff. I'm seeing noodles, beef. I don't know if there's bacon there. Okay, it exists online, though, Paul. Happy hunting. Back to your calls now. Bess is with us in Madison. Bess, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
Well, I'm wondering when you throw stuff together, if you don't have a recipe, how do you know how long to cook it for and at what temperature?
Ooh, great question, Bess. James, how do we ballpark that?
That is a very good question. So most casseroles I cook between 325 and 375. More often than not, it's going to be at 350. The way to tell when your casserole is done, usually if you're going to eyeball it, it'll start to bubble around the edges. If you've got a thermometer, stick it into the center of it, and it should be at least 165 degrees. That is what is going to be considered food safe if you're using like leftover foods and things like that. If you've got other ingredients in there like eggs, you're going to want to bring that up a little bit more so they set. But you don't have very many casseroles with a raw egg in there. So you're probably going to be fine at 165. I like it hotter than that. So I usually go by the visual of it's bubbling around the edges.
Best. Thanks for that question. And another good basic question, James, what do we cook before we put it into the casserole versus what can go in non-pre-cooked?
So if you're going to be adding vegetables and things, you want to pre-cook those. Meats, I always pre-cook those as well. And some of the reasoning being, it's like if you're going to add ground beef, think about cooking ground beef on the stovetop. You're going to get all of that grease coming off of it. You don't want that sitting in your casserole. So go ahead and cook that off. By browning it, you're going to add another layer of flavor. So I always try to get my meats pretty well browned. The vegetables, I don't try to cook fully, but just a little bit, like par cook them a little bit. And if you're going to mix harder vegetables and softer vegetables, cook the harder ones longer so they the temperature or texture of your softer vegetables so that they all kind of cook at the same pace and you're going to get the same consistency at the end. If you're going to be adding your starches like your rice or your pastas, things like that, pasta I always cook about a minute less than al dente. And the reason being is it's going to cook a little bit more when it's in the casserole. Mm. So cut back on that. Same thing with the rice. If you're going to add that, cook it a little bit less. And unless the casserole recipe calls for uncooked rice, there's a trick to doing that. So if you're going to be adding raw rice to it, you've got to know what you're doing. You're going to have a lot of liquid and figure out how much is going to be absorbed by the rice without it drying, but making sure that the rice is cooked. So it's kind of iffy in that area. But if you're having a lot of starch or something like that, I always like, my goal is like when it goes in the oven, it's a little loose. It's a little watery even. Like you're looking at it going, okay, that I don't know about that. But by the time it fully cooks, the starches absorb that, and then there's evaporation in the oven, then we'll all kind of congeal together and you're going to end up with a nice moist casserole.
It is Food Friday. We're talking about casseroles with James Shend, Wisconsin-based food writer. Back to your calls now. Terry is on the line in Pewaukee. Terry, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to pass on a recipe that I saw years ago. I think it was back in the 80s in a magazine, and it has become an absolute favorite of my family. My husband just raves about it and gets so excited when I make it. It is, and you can make it either in a 9x13 pan or a smaller 8x8 pan if you're doing it for a smaller group. But I generally make 2 pounds of ground beef. I will saute that, of course, drain off the fat. Chop up some onion and some celery, add that to it and cook that a bit. Then I will add a large can of drained canned mushrooms and then 2 cans of cheddar cheese soup. You don't dilute it. You just mix that in. That is the base layer. Then I drain 2 cans of green beans and put that over the top, and then top it all with mashed potatoes and a layer of cheddar cheese.
Wow.
Heavy on the cheddar cheese. Pop that in the oven for 350 at 350. It is absolutely delicious.
Terry, thanks a lot for sharing that. James, that definitely fits your definition of casserole you gave us right at the outset.
It certainly does. It's almost kind of like a shepherd's pie, but with a whole lot of extra to it. I love that.
Terry, thanks for that. Time for another caller. Thea is with us in Milwaukee. Thea, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your casserole to share?
So my favorite comfort food and something that my dad would make for us when we were kids is tuna casserole. And he's like the non-cook cook, but when he put this together, it was just like our favorite. So you've got the canned tuna, cream of mushroom soup, wavy noodles, diced onion, peas, and of course, potato chips. And you don't cover it for any of it because you want all the noodles and everything on top to get nice and crunchy. So it was just like maybe not the things that I would look at a recipe as an adult and go like those things would go together. But it's just so good.
All right. Now your dad made this for you, Thea. Is this something you make nowadays?
Yeah, it is. I love it. Yeah. Now I've got a little one and now I got to have her try that too.
And does she go for it? Because I hated tuna when I was a kid. I got to say, I love it now. Couldn't stand it when
yeah,
I was a kid.
Yeah, she likes it. Yeah.
Excellent. Thea, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And James, you had mentioned doing some tuna casserole yourself with the potato chips on top. Any other fun ideas to jazz up our tuna casserole?
So what I have done before, and because this was kind of I had some smoked salmon left over from a party once, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to make a tuna casserole. And then I threw in the leftover smoked salmon, and I'm like, it was amazing how well that went in the tuna casserole. It wasn't overpowering. It kind of gave that nice smoky flavor to it. And then I started thinking, what else could you do? And I'm like, swap out the tuna for canned salmon. And I'm like, entirely new, different dish. And then all the different herbs and things that you would put with it, like dill, tarragon, things like that are great with the tuna and the salmon. You could add pretty much anything. I've done the crab with a K, the fake crab, works really well in a kind of tuna casserole kind of recipe.
Thanks for that call, Thea. Just in our last few moments, James, how about freezing casseroles? That generally is going to work pretty well, right?
Almost in every single case, it's going to work just fine. And so what I've done before is I'll make the casserole, put it in my pan, but I've pre-lined that pan either with some aluminum foil, with parchment paper, something like that. And so I popped it in the freezer. And then the great thing about this is after about 24 hours, you can pull the casserole out of the pan so it's not stuck in the freezer. So you can use that until you're ready to cook the casserole. And then what I do is I'll write on the package that I've put the casserole in, what kind of pan it was, and then what it is and the date and things like that. And then when you're ready to cook it, you pull that out, drop it in the pan, and pop it in the refrigerator for overnight, and then let that thaw out. I've seen a lot of people trying to go directly from the freezer to the oven. We've got some food safety issues that I try to avoid. So what I normally do is I'll plan ahead and then just pop it in the refrigerator, let it thaw, and then go from there.
James, thanks so much for joining us today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's James Shen, Wisconsin-based food writer, former culinary deputy editor at Taste of Home. He's with us today to cook some casserole and tell us how to navigate different recipes, recipe lists, options, pans, ingredients, and more. You can keep sharing your favorites on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, I'll look at a couple of referendums we're going to see on the April ballot here in Wisconsin. It's Monday morning at 7:30 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the Friday News Roundup wraps up the world's biggest stories from China, Greenland, Ukraine, and Israel. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, if it seems like this winter has been a weaker one for the most part so far, you're not just imagining it. Aside from putting a damper on a lot of outdoor winter activities, one of the major areas of impact for milder temperatures is the formation of lake ice. According to the North American Ice Service seasonal outlook for the Great Lakes this winter, ice has overall been slow to form this year. We're going to talk about why that is and what less ice cover can mean for life in the Great Lakes and smaller ones, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about lake ice? What are you seeing in your neck of the woods? You can give us a first-hand report. When did that local lake freeze up for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jay Austin is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Minnesota Duluth, where he works at the Large Lakes Observatory. Jay, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
And Hillary Dugan is an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. Hillary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Jay, I want to start with you. I know there's a lot of variability from year to year, even month to month sometime, but big picture, what are we seeing in the Great Lakes when it comes to ice cover this year?
It's a bit of a no-show this year. The lakes in general are at less than 5% coverage. Lake Superior is maybe 1% or 2%. In a normal year, we might be at 10 or 15 in building at this stage. And so we've had a really mild winter so far, and the lakes respond to that.
Like I said, there's a lot of variability from year to year. Long-term trends, though, are we seeing less ice on average over the years?
There's still a huge amount of variability from year to year. So people who live up here probably remember 2014, the polar vortex winter. Mm-hmm. Still, by far, the heaviest ice coverage we've seen on the Great Lakes in the last 50 years, the 50 years of good ice records that we have. what we're seeing right now are more and more years with this very, very low ice coverage. And so I've been playing with some statistics recently. Over the last 50 years, from 1973 up to 1998, we had one low ice year. I think it was 1987. Since 1998, we've had nine. And we're on target for a 10th very low ice year this year. And so those sorts of events are becoming more and more common.
And Hillary, I know you have a close eye on inland lakes. How do those match up? What are we seeing in ice cover?
Well, most of our inland lakes in Wisconsin are frozen. Inland lakes are, the volume, you know, is not comparable to the Great Lakes. They can freeze so much more quickly. And so when we think about inland lakes in Wisconsin, it's usually when did they freeze and then when did they thaw? We don't have the same measurement of extent, which really gives us a much deeper insight into sort of climatological variability.
And what are we seeing when it comes to the duration? You know, how early it ices over, how late it stays frozen with lakes that you're tracking?
We're pretty lucky here to have some pretty long lake ice records. You know, the lakes in southern Wisconsin, some of them go back a century. And over the last 100 years, we've certainly seen a decrease in the duration of lake ice. We're seeing sort of later freeze up in the winter, earlier thaw in the spring. And the impacts of these polar vortex events are really noticeable. So, you know, this year, the lakes froze earlier than average because we had such a cold, you know, week or two in December right around the Christmas holiday. So they were able to freeze up. But since then, we've had this relatively mild weather, but it's hovering right around the freezing point in many regions of the state. So the ice hasn't melted, but it's certainly not thickening at the rate that we sometimes see.
We're talking to Hillary Dugan from the UW-Madison Center for Limnology and Jay Austin with the University of Minnesota Duluth's Large Lakes Observatory, looking at ice on lakes big and small or lack of ice when it comes to the Great Lakes. You could join in with your questions, your own observations. Do you have a local lake? Does it seem like it's less icy or icy for less long over the years? If you're on the Great Lakes shoreline, what are you seeing? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Jay, when we have less ice on the Great Lakes, what kind of impacts does that have on, you know, shorelines and weather patterns?
Sure. There's just a really wide variety of impacts, some of which I'm comfortable talking about and some of which are a little outside my field. Hillary can probably speak to ecological impacts more than I can. Having exposed shorelines like that means that winter storms and waves that would normally be dampened by that ice cover are impacting shorelines and causing erosion. There are issues of, for instance, impacts on the shipping season. And so there are actual economic impacts, high ice years where the shipping season is delayed. There are cultural impacts in the sense that, you know, high ice years, people are going down to the Wisconsin shore to visit the ice caves near Bayfield, or people are ice fishing in Duluth or recreating on the ice. And so there's a wide range of those sorts of impacts.
And Hillary, Jay teased my next question for you. How do ecosystems depend on ice cover and the extent of ice cover?
Well, overall, it's pretty complex. You know, ice transforms lake ecosystems because it effectively seals off the water column from the atmosphere. And so if we think about physical processes, you know, we have things like evaporation change. So if you have no lake ice, you can have a lot higher evaporation rates. And Jay's done a lot of work on that on Lake Superior. We also transform the light environment. So as soon as you have lake ice and snow on top of that ice, it attenuates light really effectively. And that's important for algae and photosynthesis. You know, they're the base of the food chain. If you're getting light penetrating into the water column, you're going to have more carbon production. It's important for timing of organismal things like fish spawning. We think about fish spawning in the fall, some other species spawn in the spring. A lot of those cues have to do with lake ice. If we have open water where wind is sort of churning up water along the shoreline, that's going to impact spawning nests. There's a lot of feedbacks on nutrient cycling. It's really there's a whole list of sort of complex interactions that lake ice fundamentally changes in lakes.
Now, a summertime thing, you mentioned algae. We often see that so-called blue-green algae, the cyanobacteria. It's gross. We don't like it in the water. Is ice part of the story of that stuff showing up in the rest of the year?
It might be. There's a lot of people working on that question, trying to think about why we might be seeing more blooms in lakes that we sort of historically didn't see a lot of cyanobacterial blooms in. The mantra has typically been that cyanobacteria like warm water, but we certainly see them in cold water. We're seeing them along the southern shore of Lake Superior in some years, and you know that's a really cold lake. So temperature isn't the whole story. We might be seeing more blooms at different times of the year if you have less lake ice means different water temperatures. It means more sunlight, again, for photosynthesis. It means potentially stirring up nutrients from the bottom of the lake. So there's lots of ways that ice could directly impact algae blooms, but it also could sort of indirectly affect them through these other drivers.
Jay, I want to talk to you a little bit about year-round Great Lake temperatures. I've spent a lot of time in Lake Superior in August, and you know, most years, once you go numb, it's not so bad. Are we seeing changes in temperatures, not just this winter ice cover, but are things changing the rest of the year?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll start by answering a slightly different question, and that actually ties into lake ice and your experience in Lake Superior in the summer. One thing that we've observed is that winter ice cover is a really good predictor of what sort of summer is about to follow. And so if you have a heavy ice year, you delay the start of the formation of warm water in the summer, and you end up having a relatively cool year. And low ice years, like, for instance, this year seems to be turning out to be, we end up with much warmer. We can start to stratify. We can start to form that layer of warm water much earlier, and we end up with a significantly warmer lake. And so that's one of the things that we've seen recently is the frequency of these low ice years suddenly increasing means the frequency of marginally swimmable water in Lake Superior has actually dramatically increased. So trends in the winter are a little more difficult because we don't have the same body of data. Most of the data that we have from the Great Lakes is collected during the summer. Surface buoys, for instance, that the federal government puts out. My lab has been putting subsurface platforms in Lake Superior since about 2007, represents one of the longer time series of year-round data. And really with 15 years of data, saying anything definitive about trends is tricky. And so I'm going to avoid that for now. But we certainly are seeing the structure of the water during the winter is very, very different between a warm year or an icy year and a cold year.
We're talking to Jay Austin, professor of physics and astronomy at the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and Hillary Dugan, assistant professor at UW-Madison Center for Limnology. We're talking about ice on lakes, Great Lakes and inland lakes, the impact it has on ecosystems, the science of it all, and why we might be seeing a shorter periods of ice coverage on the smaller lakes. Less extent of ice coverage is pretty low right now on the Great Lakes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a lake near you? Are you looking at it right now? What has ice been like in recent years on your local lake, whether you're on a Great Lake shore or on an inland lake? Do you have a question about the science of our lakes, some of the ecosystems, the importance of ice cover? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up, I'll ask each of our guests what questions they are really looking for answers for. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about lake ice with UW-Madison's Hillary Dugan from the Center for Limnology and Jay Austin, physics and astronomy professor with the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth. We are talking about ice cover, and you could join in with your questions, your own personal observations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I read somewhere that the climate change in terms of warming would affect the upper Midwest less than the coastal areas, and I wondered if that's true and why that might be.
Tom, thanks for the call with the asterisk that you're both looking at water in particular. I wonder if you have comparisons and contrasts with other parts of the country or the world. Hillary, let's start with you first of all.
Well, I'm not sure much about the comparison to the Northeast. Certainly in Wisconsin, what we're seeing is that winter is warming the fastest out of all the seasons. And so that seems to be a trend across the Midwest. In fact, what's changing the most rapidly is winter nights. We're just not getting as cold. So it's really no surprise that what we're seeing change most quickly in lakes is this duration of lake ice. Jay, do you want to jump in on that too?
Well, yeah, and Jay, yeah. I don't know if we have a lot of comparables for the Great Lakes around the world, but what are you watching for?
We can talk about the distribution of climate change effects in general. Mm-hmm. And typically, mid-continent regions are warming faster than coastal regions. Coastal regions have the oceans to sort of moderate their temperature. And mid to high latitude areas are changing faster than equatorial regions. And so where we are right now is a bit of a hotspot. And so there have been a handful of papers in the last several years compiling records of lake temperatures from lakes around the world. And the Great Lakes are right at the top of the list as far as warming rates over the last 40 years.
Tom, thanks a lot for that question at 800-642-1234. I mentioned I wanted to ask each of you what big research questions you are looking for answers on right now. Hillary, I want to start with you.
Yeah, so in inland lakes, one thing that's really interesting is what the feedbacks are of these shorter winters on the rest of the season. Jay talked a bit about the impact of ice duration on water temperatures in the Great Lakes. Certainly in inland lakes, we don't have that kind of temperature lag. They react to the weather much more quickly because they're just a smaller volume. But what we see in a lot of northern Wisconsin is we sometimes don't even see spring in lakes. It kind of goes from winter straight to summer, you know, when the lake ice comes off in May. And so as we push that back and start getting a longer spring period, what the impacts that's going to have on sort of lake biology.
Interesting. And Jay, what question do you have your eye on?
Something that's I've wondered about for a long time, and it's funny that this seems like something we should have nailed down a long time ago. I've mentioned that air temperature plays a huge role in determining the amount of lake ice. In fact, air temperature is almost the entire game. It's sort of amazing how tight the relationship is between winter, average winter air temperature, and the amount of ice that forms. And it doesn't sound like rocket science, right? But the interesting thing is it doesn't depend on how windy it was. It doesn't depend on how much precipitation. It doesn't depend whether the previous summer was warm or cold. All that matters is what is the winter air temperature. I can tell you how much ice will form. The trick is the amount of ice that forms is really sensitive to the air temperature. And the difference between a year where there's basically no open lake ice and a year where there's really substantial open lake ice can be due to a difference in air temperature of 3 or 4 degrees Fahrenheit on average. And so one thing I'd really like to work on that I am working on, I should say, is understanding the root of that sensitivity.
Talking to Jay Austin from the University of Minnesota Duluth and Hillary Dugan from UW-Madison Center for Limnology, looking at ice on lakes, why there's more or less of it from year to year, the impact it has. Back to your calls now. Peter is with us in Pewaukee. Peter, hello.
Hello. Thank you for the show. About 20, 25 years ago, myself and my kids were in Cornucopia, Wisconsin, and I knew about this beach, and I knew that there were some differences in temperature. Told them to bring a sweatshirt, but they wouldn't listen. When we were in the parking lot, it was 81 degrees. When we got down by the water, it was 59 degrees, and this is in the middle of the summer. Do we still have that big difference of temperatures, air temperatures, during the summer along Lake Superior?
Peter, thanks for that call. A cliche in Wisconsin public radio weather, cooler near the lake. Jay, Cornucopia, that's just along the coast from where you are in Duluth there. That's not uncommon, right, that kind of temperature differential near the lake?
So I have observed in Duluth, Duluth is a very steep city, you know, plunging right down into Lake Superior, and the best I've seen was up, if you go up, we call it up the hill, to go shopping or something like that. It was 80 degrees up the hill and 40 by the lake.
Wow.
And so And it's like literally 2 or 3 miles. And it's all just that elevation and being very, very close to the lake. The other thing that may be going on at a site like that, depending on how the wind is blowing, you can bring the cooler deep water up to the surface and have extremely cool water in the middle of the summer. And so if you're swimming on the North Shore and the wind blows just the right direction, the water temperature can drop from a very, very comfortable, you know, 65 or 70 degrees in the middle of the summer to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, which is actually life-threatening. So you have to pay attention.
Peter, thanks for the call. Tom joins us now in Northeast Wisconsin. Tom, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that I grew up in Northeast Wisconsin and kind of watched. We would wait for deer season was in November. We'd always hope we could go ice fishing the last week in the deer season and then kind of watch and record the dates when the ice come off the lake. There's been some years where ice would come off in March. I remember we were building a house. I work outside, so I watch the climate and temperature weather all the time. And one year in March, it got warm, 70 degrees, and we watched the ice break off and come across. Other year, I remember not too long ago, ice was on the lake in the first part of May yet. We couldn't even go trout fishing and whatnot. It was so cold.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. We don't have a ton of time left, but Hillary, do you or your colleagues at the Center for Limnology look to people like Tom for citizen science observations about their local lakes?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of groups that are trying to collect data on just that type of observation. And one of the reasons that we have such good long-term records on lake ice occurrence is people wrote it down. They were interested in it. It impacted their lives and what they could do on lake ice. And, you know, Tom's right. What we're seeing in these long-term records is, yes, there's a trend of shorter ice duration, but there's huge variability in freeze up and thaw now. And so, you know, maybe 50 years ago, you were pretty sure your lake was going to freeze deer hunting week and it was going to thaw in the last week of April. And now we're seeing, you have no idea what's going to happen. Maybe it'll thaw in March or maybe it'll thaw in May. And it mostly has to do with these polar vortex events we're now getting.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Jay, I wanted to ask, what I know ice coverage can change still over the course of a season. What are you watching for in the next couple of months?
Well, the current outlook is relatively mild where we are. And so we're running out of time to form a lot of ice. I say that if you look at the records from last year, we had a little bit more ice than we do at this time. We have a little bit more ice, but we had an amazingly cold January and February last year. And we ended up topping out at about 80% coverage in Lake Superior. So it could still happen, but from the sort of medium to long-term forecasts that I've seen, the likelihood of that is getting smaller and smaller all the time.
We'll leave it there. Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Hillary, thanks for being with us.
Always happy to talk about lakes.
We've been talking to Jay Austin, professor of physics and astronomy with the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and Hillary Dugan, assistant professor at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. We talked to them about the relatively low levels of Great Lakes ice so far this winter, and then the duration of ice on inland lakes, the impact that has on life around the lakes and the ecosystems in the lakes themselves. If you have a local observation to share with us or a picture of your local icy lake, we like pictures. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Love to see what's going on near you. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, there are efforts to lower carbon dioxide emissions to stop global warming and efforts to remove CO2 that's already in the atmosphere. A Wisconsin scientist is going to join the show to share a new report on those efforts to remove carbon dioxide from the air. And the new 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline is online and active. We'll find out what that's meant so far for Wisconsin and look at the kind of response it's been getting. Check out that and catch up on some of the latest news of the day. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.